From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Sydney Grannon, sitting in for Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst, and he's also a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Hi, Tom.
Hello, everybody.
Later this hour, we'll be talking with Alexandria Mayor Justin Wilson. But joining us now in studio is Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich. County Executive, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
Before we get into Montgomery County, Tom Sherwood, there's more news about possible changes to the D.C. Housing Authority, which handles the city's public housing. We know the D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser and Council Chair Phil Mendelson introduced emergency legislation to reform the board that oversees the agency, but now two council members have proposed different legislation.
Yes, this will come up on Tuesday. The mayor's proposed this. The Housing Authority, just so people will know, handles 8,000 units of public housing, and it's been a horrible mess for years, for decades even. One-fourth of the housing units are not even habitable, and in the maintenance, all those things. It's just a terrible situation. Mm-hmm. Now the mayor's proposed a change, which actually would give her more authority over the board, not as if she didn't have enough already. And two council members want to make it more independent. Alyssa Silverman, who we'll talk about in a moment, and Brooke Pinto, the Ward 2 council member, they've proposed this dramatic restructuring of the Housing Authority, played off against what the mayor wants. And so that we'll see how that plays out on Tuesday.
And it's my understanding that's actually permanent legislation, not emergency legislation. So it'll actually have to be reintroduced next session because regular legislation needs two votes.
Right. Yeah, that's a little bit complicated about how it works. But there are two proposals. Mm-hmm. And one is we'll quickly give the mayor more authority. And one will take a little longer to play out. But the point is the people in the public housing now are suffering and have been for years. And something needs to be done and as quickly as possible.
And just quickly, someone else we know has weighed in on this, Attorney General Carl Racine, who is an outgoing Attorney General. What does he have to say?
Well, he's got one foot out the door. He'll be out of office January 2nd. But, you know, this has been an issue for him, and he has proposed his own reforms. He and Alyssa Silverman, the council member, have been allies. So I think all of these things are mixed up where the council and the Attorney General, lame duck Attorney General, are aligned against the mayor's interests and the chairman of the council. It's a great political battle, which will be played out on Tuesday.
Yeah. And speaking of outgoing D.C. council member Alyssa Silverman, the D.C. Board of Elections threw out a complaint against her from the Office of Campaign Finance, saying she had misspent public campaign funds. And I should mention, Tom, you were the first person to break this news.
Well, that's because I was listening to the to the public meeting. Of, you know, you can find out a hell of a lot if you just happen to listen to public bodies meeting. And so I was listening. But the three-member Board of Elections overturned the Office of Campaign Finance, which just before the election in November said Silverman had violated the law by doing a poll in the Ward 3 race, which she was not part of. Mm-hmm. And it turns out the law is fairly fuzzy because it says you can only do polling for things that directly or indirectly affect your campaign, which suggests to me you can do any kind of poll in the world. But anyway, that ruling came out right on the eve of the election. Silverman lost. There were other reasons she lost, but that's a big one. And then she appealed it, and the Board of Elections this week voted unanimously to vacate that ruling, mm-hmm. saying she did not violate the law. So personally, it's a win for her, but it comes bittersweet that she lost her election.
Yeah, definitely. Now on to County Executive Mark Elrich, and I'm going to toss to you first, Tom Sherwood, because there's stuff going on with the County Planning Board that has been in chaos since the board abruptly quit in November.
Well, forced to quit.
Forced to quit.
Yeah, we don't, you know, this is the Politics Hour. We try to stay away from hardcore public policy issue, but the Planning Board in Montgomery County is an crucial board. If you've heard something called Thrive 2050 and all those things, the Planning Board is the source of what the future of the county is going to look like. And it's been in turmoil for months now. And this week, there's been legislation proposed by State Senator Ben Cramer would give the county executive some authority, a task force to see how can they redo this board. But what I want to ask is the politics around it. I listened to some of the council meeting. I watched some of the meeting last night. Ben Cramer is more bitter than I've ever heard him, complaining that people on the council and public people called in have misrepresented what he was trying to do. And I'm just wondering, Kramer is trying to change the board, which would actually give you some authority, wouldn't it? Directly, I realize that's a point of contention, but I'm just wondering, it seems to me that this is almost too personal and that the hardening of opinions risk hurting your relationship with the new county council that just sworn in this week and straining personal relations. I'm wondering if Ben Kramer should apologize for the toxic words he used when he was fighting back with critics of his proposal.
I didn't actually listen to the language, so I don't know whether he said something he should apologize for.
But he said that people were lying, which always is, it's a lie. I mean, maybe people are lying, but I'm just wondering, in terms of politics, is this thing getting out of control with council and new council members?
I don't think it'll get out of control. Mm-hmm. I don't think people have fairly represented what he intended to do. Okay. I will say, I wasn't part of the writing of it.
So of his legislation.
So I was kind of surprised that I was going to appoint all these people, but I do think there needs to be a review of the planning process. And I think what's missed in all this, people have taken this as a criticism of the board or the staff. It has nothing to do with the board or the staff. What I was interested in, what attracted me to it, is we have the worst planning process probably in the region. Everybody else says you go through one door, you go to the planning staff or permitting staff or zoning staff. They get you ready. You go in front of the planning board. They tell you what they want, and then it comes back, and you leave through the same door. Montgomery County, unique among everybody, has got dueling agencies approving projects and setting requirements for projects. It is the bane of the existence of the development community. And you know me. I am not exactly the guy who says, man.
Well, you're not the spokesman for the development community. But in the county council, which does have authority over the board, made them all resign. It's still not clear to me and other people why they made them resign. But we're beyond that now. And so we've got temporary members of the planning board now. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if the politics is going to interfere. I listened to I watched your speech. Your inaugural speech about all the ambitious things you want to do with housing and climate control, all of these different things. But if the county council members are torn apart over plans for the planning board, it seems to me that could hurt your ambitious agenda going forward, not to count the fact that we'll probably be in recession next year and there'll be some concerns about what you'll be able to do.
Well, I actually don't think...
Am I being negative enough for the media?
I'd say, you know, you're kind of moderate out there. You could be Fox News. No, look, I don't think it's going to do that. I think people have their opinions. I think that, you know, the council could easily fix the appointment issue, and or Ben could fix it, or other members of the legislature could fix that. I think it's absolutely wrong for people to pretend that our process works and that we shouldn't figure out how to make it more efficient. What I was saying about the developer piece is we ask for a lot, and I'm probably going to be asking for more. But if I'm going to ask for more and I see a process where we get no value out of a process which adds time and expense to what they do, if it takes me 2 years to what you could do in 1 year, that's an extra year of interest and an extra year of inflation. So I don't want to cause more pain than I need to while trying to reform a process so it works better for everybody.
So the politics of it, Kramer is saying that the council members, he said what they were saying about his proposal is a lie. He didn't call them liars, he said it's a lie. I'm just wondering if things are going to be off track on this, and it's going to, as you know, personal relationships affect everything.
We should mention that the majority of the Montgomery County Council voted to oppose the two bills that Senator Kramer put in. And so what does that mean of the fate of the bills? I believe they have to be passed by the General Assembly.
Right. I mean, the legislature may look at the mess that you referred to and say, you know, regardless of what the council thinks, we think, because this is ultimately a state agency, this is an agency that needs some reform. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I will ask.
Did it come up this morning in the council, the delegation breakfast or whatever?
We did not discuss it this
morning. Oh, well, let's move on to the delegation breakfast, because it's my understanding you were there. It's my understanding that Governor-elect Moore was there.
Yeah.
What did he talk about?
He talked about, you know, his kind of broader agenda for things. And, you know, there are a number of things that are exciting. First place, we can work with them. I don't have to worry about a governor who's going to attack us because we have an immigration policy that's welcoming. I don't have to worry about a governor who's going to say, I don't want you protecting people from COVID as much as you're willing to do it. So that's a real positive. Big things are, he acknowledges we got to move forward with the blueprint for schools. Mm-hmm. And that's not just a county problem. This is a state issue. And that's important to us because we've always known there are going to be added expenses with this. There's no way you do something bigger, different, and more comprehensive and get it for free.
Did he talk on these issues? Because he's talked about spending a lot of money. Governor Hogan is already warning the new legislature. He just rolled his eyes, if you can't see. County executive just rolled his eyes when I mentioned Governor Hogan. But he's warned that the economy is weakening, could be in recession, and not to spend all the money. But is that an issue for you?
Well, nobody said he had to spend everything. Right. And, you know, his financial people, as they go through the spring, you'll get a much clearer sign of what the odds of a recession and how deep the recession would be. I would imagine if they felt they had to hold money in reserve, if they don't already have reserves. I mean, we do have reserves, so this is like extra money. Mm-hmm. So they can make that discussion about whether the reserves will buffer them from a recession or they need some of this money to do it. But if you're going to make the steps he wants to make in early childhood education, and he understands very clearly that is the key to getting kids on a level playing field so we can finally begin to close the gap. We talked about it even in Montgomery County for more than 30 years.
Right.
It's not going anywhere.
Right. I'm curious if the issue of I-495 and I-270 came up this morning, or if you've talked to it with Governor-elect Moore in any other case. On this show, on the Politics Hour in August, Moore said he wants to see a new type of proposal that includes reversible lanes and mass transit. Do you have any updates from us from him as he talked to you about it?
No, we sat through a meeting where the state presented its program. And they, you know, basically represented the deal they've got with Transurban. And then that's the master developer. And Moore's made it very clear that that's nice. And now we're going to go forward and look at it and see if we can do it better. What I think everybody who's got a dog in this fight and is concerned about fixing the problem, Moore's as committed to fixing the problem as Hogan is. But I think he's going to be much more surgical and not buy into a project that's way more expensive than it needs to be because maybe it's politically useful to do, say, I built the biggest P3 project in the country and focus, can I build the best project in the country? It may or may not need to be a P3.
There's a lot of national attention to the new governor-elect, Wes Moore.
Yep.
He's getting national attention everywhere. I mean, some people are already talking about him as a potential vice presidential candidate in the 2024 elections. And, of course, in Virginia, Governor Youngkin is acting like he's going to be – he's got the vapors for national office also. Is there any concern at all that the expectations for Wes Moore are too high, that he won an overwhelming victory in the election? He's virtually reached out to every constituency and said, I'm with you. We're going to do stuff. I'm just wondering, again, with the economy not as good as people expect, is he going to be able to move and satisfy the expectations that his victory has created?
I think he can do a lot. And if all he has to do is start with a little bit more measured steps for the first year of dealing with a recession, as long as he puts things in place and lays out where we're going to go in this state, I think he's going to be fine. This recession, more and more people are talking about being shallow, not deep, and short, not long, which means you come through this, it'll recover at the end of us, just like interest rates will come back down at some point. Home buying will resume. Recreation and transfer taxes
will
resume.
That's the optimistic view.
It always happens.
Okay.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Mark Elrich. He is the Montgomery County Executive. We have a call about the planning board, tangentially related to the planning board, from Susan in Bethesda. Susan, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Elrich. I'm very concerned about the bike paths that have been opened up on Old Georgetown Road. There was a very well-organized campaign by the bikers from over months, apparently, and they obviously have a lot of clout. The bike lanes were put in place without any real understanding of what was going on, and nobody did their due diligence on the subject. So I would like to know what went on. Two people have sadly been killed but from what I understand, it was due to them not being able to bike on the path. And they had to, went into the road where they were sadly hit.
Okay, thank you for that call, Susan. Let's let the county executive respond.
So I'm a little concerned because I don't think, you know, I don't see many signs of real public outreach. They may have reached out to the biking community. That's nice. It's not clear at all that they've reached out to everybody else. And that, by what we're seeing, is a whole lot of people who are not political newbies wondering, how did this happen? And so, you know, my questions for the state is, what is your analysis, and particularly what's your traffic analysis? Because you're taking out a whole lane for a long stretch of the road. That's not exactly a congestion-free area. And so I want to know what they think is going to happen, and we'll monitor what happens.
Were these bike lanes then under the jurisdiction of the state and not
state
under
highway.
Their... Okay, so that partially, I hope that partially answers your question, Susan, of it's a state issue. We got an email from Wendy. Can the county consider recycling sites in somewhere close to Silver Spring or Tacoma Park? Those of us living in high-density areas of the county also have things to recycle. And then also from Martin in Bethesda, as a longtime recycler, why should we carefully clean our plastic containers when only less than 10% of them gets recycled?
More than 10% of your stuff gets recycled if it goes into the recycling bins and winds up in the county. Mm-hmm. Right now, because our plastic overran the capacity of our plastic processor, we've been shipping stuff out. But we are contracting now with a new facility that's going to separate plastics by color and by plastic type, which and have the capacity for the plastic we have, which means we're actually going to make more money on the plastic, because instead of selling a flat of intercommingled plastic, we're going to be able to sell it by color and type that has far more value. So please bear with us. Keep doing it. We're going to make this better.
Your first term was hampered by COVID. You had to do a lot to make the whole county switch into emergency mode. You've in your speech this week, you praised the county for doing so, and that's a good thing. But a lot of people think COVID is over, but Montgomery County has now recommended that people start wearing masks again in congregate settings. I was hoping we'd never hear that phrase again, but congregate settings in public, wearing masks. Other counties are thinking about it.
Yeah.
Are you concerned at all? What is the status? And you have a new health director for the county, which is good. What is the concern that COVID, flu, and that RSV thing will create real havoc for your county as you try to get all these things done that we've just talked about?
So the good news is that if you're vaccinated and you manage to get a breakthrough case of COVID, the cases tend to be mild. You don't wind up hospitalized and you don't wind up seriously sick. For people who aren't vaccinated, they still die. And for people who aren't vaccinated or only got the first shot, they're greater risk of getting a more severe illness, particularly older people. So we're happy that 57% of people over 65 are vaccinated, but our percentage under 65, not so good. The concern, though, is the hospitals, which is the thing we started looking at early on in COVID, was as we were looking at surges, we were looking at hospital capacity. And the big concern is between flu, RSV, and COVID, are we going to push the hospital emergency rooms to the point they can't handle people? We already have had days when some of the emergency rooms are overloaded. It impacts long-term care. They start prioritizing who gets a bed and who doesn't get a bed. You don't want a hospital to decide who stays and who doesn't. You want them to be medical.
I don't think the public is aware that we're in this dangerous situation. Now, you do. I want one public service announcement. On Saturday in Wheaton, there is a
Boosterama.
A Boosterama.
Who came up with that name, Boosterama?
It might be Scott.
Scott Peterson, as he was talking about. All right. What is that going to be very quickly in 30 seconds? Where is it and what it is to get people vaccinated?
Westfield, right? Wheaton. I think it's 10 a.m. to 1 a.m.
Wheaton Mall. They only Wheaton always Mall. Have to say That's Westfield.
Wheaton Mall, where I used
Wheaton
to hang
Mall,
out.
If you know where that is.
And it's they have both the
10
new
to 1.
Bivalent vaccine, and they also have the flu shots. So you can get both. I got both of mine. I got mine a day apart because they didn't have them both available, but other people have had them the same day. They say you can perfectly well do it the same day. So we're trying to go out to where people are and say, this is the biggest shopping day of the year. Please come here.
Yeah. That's the end of the public service announcement.
Just quickly, because we were talking about masking, why a recommendation and not a requirement? And is there a world in which a requirement might come back to the county?
So the world in which a requirement might come back is if our cases per 100,000 get much higher than where we're at 121 now per 100,000, which is above where we were before. So if that were to continue to climb, if the rate of spread were to continue to climb, and if the hospitals, which is the critical piece, looks like they're going to fill up, and that if the peak follows a trend, we are for sure going to overwhelm them, that would be the time you'd see something more mandatory.
I got to ask you about rent stabilization. Yeah. You talked about it. 40% of the residents of Montgomery County are renters. Last week, Evan Glass was on this program, the council president. I tried to get him to tell me what rent stabilization means. Does it mean rent control? What do you want to do to protect the Renters Alliance in Montgomery County this week had a forum. They said evictions are increasing and self-evictions where people are having to leave homes before they get evicted are increasing. What do you want the county to do about rent stabilization to hold down rent increases?
I want the county to put in place a rent stabilization law that ties the basic annual increase to the inflation rate, that allows landlords to get increases above the inflation rate when they demonstrate that their costs exceed.
It's just rent control, and is that rent stabilization just politically a better way of saying rent control?
Well, we don't dictate dollars and what it can be. So we, it's like we're not stipulating a one bedroom is this and a two bedroom is. We're just basically saying this is the cap.
Rent increases. Inflation's pretty high, so that would be a significant increase.
So it's high this year, but most of the years we've had years where the increase would have been closer to 1%. But we want to track it to that because the amount of poverty or the amount of people who can't afford rents in this county without spending half their income on rent is enormous, and we have overlooked that. And our housing programs do not serve people below $60,000 by and large. So I've got, tons
of people.
Do you
think the council will pass this before spring?
And we should know that the council is majority new. We have six new members on an 11-person council.
So we're targeting it for some action in the spring. We're not targeting it for trying to jam this through in a month.
Okay.
And we'll send over a set of comprehensive proposals that include some other things to try to preserve the affordable housing stock in the county.
Okay, here now is Bruce in Wheaton. Bruce, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Elrich. Mr. Elrich, I have a question which I previously asked all members of the current county council, and all of them did not respond. It's a very simple question, but hard to answer. And the question is, should large residential parking garages be permitted or encouraged to be built within walking distance of a metro station anywhere in the county? What prompted this question was the fact that the planning board has given preliminary approval to a new development to be called Wheaton Gateway, directly across from the Wheaton Mall, which will contain 900 units of housing, which I support, but multiple levels and hundreds of new parking spaces, which will promote gridlock.
Okay, we don't have a great deal of time, Bruce, so let me let the county executive respond.
As quick as I can, I support parking limits, the capping the number of spaces, and I've always supported stricter limits than what the park and planning or the council, past councils have approved. I won't speak for this council. If one wants to reduce the number of people using auto vehicles and wants to break the rush hour jams, you need to put more aggressive limits on parking because that helps us drive transit numbers. So I see these two things interacting with each other. So my answer is, I don't want the solution to be parking, and I don't want one parking space for every apartment that's within, close distance of Metro, but they may need some. Maybe not as much as we do.
That's all the time we have. Mark Elrich is the Montgomery County Executive. County Executive, thank you for coming in. When we come back, we'll be talking with Alexandria Mayor Justin Wilson. You're listening to The Politics Hour. I'm Sydney Grannon, filling in for Kodjo Namdi. Welcome back to the Politics Hour on WAMU 88.5. I'm Sydney Grannan, sitting in for Kojo Namdi. With me in studio is Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. And joining us now is Justin Wilson, the mayor of the city of Alexandria. Mayor Wilson, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
Now, before we get to the mayor and Alexandria, specifically Tom Sherwood, we have to talk about what's been going on in Loudoun County, where two school officials have been indicted by a Virginia grand jury over how they handled a pair of sexual assault cases in the school system.
Well, the former superintendent, Scott Ziegler, who's been fired, has been indicted on a variety of misdemeanors for his testimony or what he said, did about the student who went to two different schools and assaulted other students. And the other person, Wade Bayard, or Bayard, is the press person. He's been charged with a felony. I'm not quite maybe because he said something in testimony, it's not clear. But again, this is the ongoing saga of Loudoun County school system, which was brought into the public fights during the campaigns for governor last year. And it's just a real mess there. And this is just the latest thing. The former superintendent says he wasn't even interviewed by the grand jury, and he would have been glad to talk about what he did or didn't do. But it's just more trouble for Loudoun County.
Yeah. And just bringing the mayor in for a second, I know mishandling of sexual assault cases is by no means unique to Loudoun County. And I know this is like a worst nightmare scenario for any school system. How are things going in Alexandria in terms of any issues in the school system? Or is there anything like this going on? Does the school system have plans in place? If are you confident, seeing what's happening in Loudoun, that the Alexandria Public Schools would be able to effectively address something like this?
Well, I mean,
and you don't control the school.
And we should mention.
I do not. We do not. Yeah. But we certainly have a partnership with our school board and school administration to ensure the safety of our schools and ensure that that everyone's able to get an education there. I'm a parent of two children at our high school, and so certainly success and thriving kids in our schools is important. I read the grand jury report in Loudoun County. It's disturbing. I mean, it's absolutely disturbing. There's stuff in that report that should never happen in a school, and clearly there's a lot of blame to go around in that situation. I'll leave it to the friends in Loudoun County to manage through that. I think it's instructive though for every school system, and I know certainly in Alexandria a lot of our folks read that report, and we'll certainly check systems and processes and procedures and make sure this is not something that could happen here.
And the Board of Elections the elections for board members in Loudoun County can maybe address this more fully for all the counties. Residents. Yeah.
Really quickly, this Sunday, Metro will stay open later to accommodate fans of the Washington Commanders. The football team has a pivotal game against the Giants this weekend, and I have a feeling our friend Randy Clark at WMATA has something to do with this.
Yes, the general manager is trying to make Metro more user-friendly, and in the past, you know, these rides haven't been made available. But I will say this, there might be free rides for more Giants fans than Commanders fans when they get there. The other good news is for more of the people in our region is Metro on New Year's Eve will be free, bus and rail, from 8 o'clock to, I think, 2 in the morning on New Year's Eve. So New Year's Eve is the deadliest day for drunk driving. So if you're going to go somewhere and you want to get dressed up, try Metro, try public transportation. It's going to be free. It's good for the workers who are working late. It's good for the people out partying and drinking too much. I will be home and probably asleep by 11.
You will be coming to First Night Alexandria in Old Town, Tom.
You serve alcohol at
First
Night.
We would love to host you. It's an alcohol-free event, but there's plenty of establishments in Old Town that will serve you alcohol on New Year's
Eve. I'll give that event all the attention it deserves.
Oh, come on. We'll see you there.
Justin Wilson is the mayor of Alexandria. He's a Democrat. If you want to join the conversation, do it now. These segments go very fast. You can give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send us an email to kojo@wamu.org, a tweet at Politics Hour, or reach us on Facebook at The Politics Hour. Because we talked about Metro, let's go into some big news. WMATA announced this week that the Potomac Yard Metro Station is expected to open in May of next year. That's about a year delay, I believe, from its expected opening date.
Ish.
Are you confident the transit agency will meet that opening date in May?
Well, I long since learned to not bank and make any guarantees regarding Metro opening dates or milestones. We are in constant communication. I'm personally in constant communication with Mr. Clark and his team on the opening of the station. I feel better, more optimistic about this opening date than I certainly have about previous dates. But we'll certainly be working very closely side by side with WMATA's team to make sure that they meet this date. This is very important. It's not just the opening of the Potomac Yard Metro Station, which we've been waiting about a quarter of a century for, but it's also going to be restoring the Yellow Line. We have not had the Yellow Line.
In May.
It should be around the same timing is what I think they're going to end up doing, and that's very exciting. It's been a huge inconvenience for commuters in the city of Alexandria for the last several months, including the period where we had no Blue Line either, and so we're happy to have that back, and getting back to normal would be a big welcome
thing. This is where I have to make a disclosure. I live in the Delray neighborhood of Alexandria, yeah. Near the Braddock Metro line, and so that did personally affect me.
Mm-hmm. As well.
Yeah, just quickly, can you remind us why the Potomac Yard Center or Metro Station is going to be important? Because I know there's the Potomac Yard Center there. It's a shopping area with a Target and a PetSmart. There's a lot of construction. It's not particularly pedestrian friendly. I feel safer in a car in that area. So what's the plan, just quickly, for that area?
Yeah, well, first of all, this was a rail yard. This was one of the most significant rail yards on the East Coast. This was a significant industrial site, and this has been a Target redevelopment area for us for a long time.
And this, can we just point out, this is where the football team, now the Commanders, were going back in late 1980s when Doug Wilder was governor. They were going to put the new football, then called the Redskins football stadium there, and the people rose up and said, we don't want that.
We pushed that back, and I think what we wanted a mixed-use future for that site, and Metro is key to that. And so that shopping center you're talking about is actually the area that's going to redevelop. We're in the process right now of building a new Virginia Tech campus there, what they call the Innovation Campus, which is part of the Amazon attraction effort. It was the higher education component of Virginia's effort to attract Amazon to just north of the city in Arlington, and this is a real economic development engine for us. There's a lot of commercial tenants who have come to Potomac Yard, more that will come in the future because of the location of that station, and a lot of that future redevelopment that's going to happen on the site of the shopping center is going to happen because Metro is there.
That's not going to be part of what's being called National Landing, is it?
It is technically part of what National. I'm a Potomac Yard purist. I will call
Potomac Yard Crystal City.
It will be Potomac Yard and Crystal City forever, as far as I'm concerned.
National Landing.
But National Landing is the name that JBG.
I'm going to have to get over that name if I'm going to go shopping there.
We'll call it Potomac Yard for you and me.
All right. Can we ask you about COVID again? Because we just talked. Montgomery County in Maryland has recommended people wear masks again in public settings. Other jurisdictions have not. I don't think have done that, but people are talking about it. People, particularly for older people, in immunocompromised people, it looks like COVID is making a rebound because of flu and the RSV virus. What is the situation in your city, and should people be wearing masks on King Street and other places where people gather?
Well, I think we have never stopped suggesting that for folks who are vulnerable, folks who have any health risks or comorbidities that are associated with COVID, you should wear a mask. You should protect yourself. We've always obviously encouraged people to get vaccinated, get boosted. We had one of the highest vaccination rates in the Commonwealth, and unfortunately, our booster rate has not been where we'd like it to be, and so we're certainly still promoting.
People are acting like it's over.
Yeah, unfortunately they are. And so, we're certainly encouraging people to get boosted and get those bivalent boosters, and they're widely accessible in the city of Alexandria. And then if folks are in a vulnerable situation due to health reasons or family members or whatever, they should wear a mask, absolutely. And we're certainly seeing some of that rebound as well, and our hospitals are busier than ever, not necessarily because of COVID, but because of everything all at once. And so it's certainly a challenge for us.
Before we get on to some more nitty-gritty politics, I did want to do one more transportation issue, which was the Dash bus system.
Oh, good. I was going to do that.
Oh,
it shows that we don't discuss these issues in advance. We know we're going to talk about them. Yeah. And I was going to ask the very next question about Dash.
It's great because in September of 2021, Alexandria made it completely free. You just hop on. It's amazing. You don't have to pay. You just say hello. The city just released a report on how it's been going. Of course, residents of D.C. are really interested in this because of the new plan to make D.C. Metro buses free starting next summer. So what did the report find?
Well, I think the report found that we saw increased ridership. We're ahead of pre-pandemic levels, which is very unusual for bus systems around this region. It showed that it benefited all of our residents, but particularly our low-income residents. It's very popular with residents. And I think we've seen a real rise, particularly with students. And I've seen that my own as a regular Dash rider myself. You know, some of those Dash routes are operating as basically school buses in a lot of cases, as well as making it easier for kids to get to after-school jobs and things like that. And so it's really helped it become a no-brainer. But I think what's important to emphasize is it's not just the fare free. What we did at the exact same time is we completely started over again on our route network. We had Dash has been around since 1984, and our route structure has largely remained the same since that point. We've added routes, but the structure has remained the same. We started over. We said, where do people live? Where are they going now in 2022? And we built a route structure that provided more frequent service to the areas of our city where people live and where they are going. And so, you know, you can provide free buses until you're blue in the face. People aren't going to ride a free bus if it's not going where they need to go. And so we did those both at the same time. And so what I've emphasized for WMATA and for the region is you got to do the same thing. And so I know WMATA is talking about the same thing we did with our route structure. They're having that conversation, and I think that's so vitally important.
Well, the district is planning, if it all goes well, to make any bus originating in the district free in July, starting in July. But I don't know how big the Metro WMATA bus system is in Alexandria. Is it significant? Is it just rush hour interest? Would you actually get to the point where you would like to see Metro do free busing?
So first of all, yes, I would like to see a place where busing is free. I think one challenge we have from a communications perspective right now in the city is that we have Dash routes and Metro routes. Mm-hmm. I use both regularly. Mm-hmm. I used a Dash this morning, but a lot of times I use Metro, and you know, Metro charges and Dash doesn't. And so
right.
I think there is a consistency issue we have to work through. Metro is important. Metro bus is important in the city of Alexandria. Not just are they providing regional routes that serve the city, they also run Metroway, which is the region's first bus rapid transit system that runs on Route 1. And that's a very important system for us, particularly during that shutdown you talked about earlier with the Blue Line. It was very important to have Metroway running. And so we rely on the whole network in the city.
Let me ask you about Randy Clark, the new general manager. I'm sure, I think I saw a picture of you and him together.
Yeah, been together a couple times.
It seems to me that he's done something, even though he's in a honeymoon period. Let's give him that. He has made an effort. He and I think it's his wife, they actually ride Metro. He tweets about that. He was promoting the Silver Line, which is opened. He seems to be getting around talking to all the power structure in this region that's going to support Metro. So he seems to be doing a good job. Can he do the one thing which everyone wants, which is to get the federal government to recognize that federal workers are a big part of the Metro system, and the federal government ought to pay part of the operating costs, just like Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. do?
Well, let me first of all say I think you're right. Mr. Clark's off to a great job. He's doing great work across the region. He's very visible, which is great, and I think he's tackling a lot of very difficult challenges. That is a thankless job, as you know, leading WMATA, particularly at this time. You know, and whether he can get what you're describing, I think that's all of our tasks. That's not just Randy Clark's task. That's not just the board's task. That's all of our tasks, is to get the federal government to do their fair share for the system. And I think we're facing, and I think we all need to acknowledge this, we are facing a significant financial reckoning in Metro, particularly because we are not going to see the ridership on Metro Rail get back to where it was before anytime soon. And I think anyone who rides, and I'm a nearly daily rider of both Metro Rail, Metro Bus, and Dash, and I can tell you that while the bus ridership came back on both Metro Bus and Dash, the Metro Rail is, I mean, it feels like a Saturday most days that I'm riding, and that's just that is a huge financial challenge for the system, and one that we're all going to have to tackle.
Before we move on from transportation, here is Lana in Del Rey. Lana, you are on the air. Go
you
ahead,
pick
please.
Del Rey's caller because you live in Del Rey. See, this is how the media works.
Lana, go ahead, please.
They comment about it not being pedestrian friendly to get to Potomac Yard. I wanted to say, yes, the Dash bus goes right up through the middle of Del Rey between King Street Metro and Potomac Yard, and then goes back down the same way. And it's free, and it's warm, And don't forget about Dash. And I also wanted to say thank you to Justin, because I know he works about 24 hours a day.
Thank you for that call, Lana. There's too much
thank
praise.
Thank you, Mrs. Wilson.
There's too much praise on this show, I think.
Thank you, Lana. And let me just say that when the Potomac Yard Metro opens, we have Dash routes that will be rerouted to serve that new station. And so we're going to be making new connections in that station throughout the city, which will be exciting.
I want to move on to some state politics.
Yes, so do I.
Great.
That's good.
Take it away, Tom Sherwood.
I want to ask if this is, you have endorsed Jennifer McClellan, who ran for governor in 2021. She's a state senator from Richmond. The Democrat, you're a Democrat. The Democrats are trying to fill the 4th district seat, which is a congressional seat in the Richmond area, because Congressman Don McEachin, who everyone liked, died of colon cancer at age 61, I think. But because of the way the state law is written, the Democrats have to have a quick primary for a February election, and the primary is a firehouse primary, show-up primary on Tuesday.
That's right.
Jennifer McClellan, who ran a really good campaign for governor, I think you supported her in a fundraiser I tried to find out about back in 2020. But the fact is, she seems to have generated a lot of support from the two governors, I mean, two state senators, Mark Warner and Tim Kaine. But another state senator, Joe Morrissey, is also running in that race. You've endorsed Senator McClellan. You've said you've known her for 25 years. One, how have you known her for 25 years? And why would she be the right person to join the Democrats in Congress? And this is a district where the Republicans have very little chance of winning.
Yeah, so I've known Jennifer. We got our starts both in Virginia Young Democrats 25 years ago, and I think the world of her. And I've seen her in both the House of Delegates and in the state Senate emerge as a really important leader and a legislator that does her homework and turns really good ideas into policy. And so I think she will be a great member of the House of Representatives. She does have to get through that that firehouse primary caucus that's coming up. It's one of these turnarounds, real quick turnaround. It's a matter of who can get the most people to show up at a, you know, middle school or rec center on a Tuesday, and I know they're working their tails off to make that happen.
And even though, again, this congressional district is not in our immediate listening area in Northern Virginia, she very well knows the problems in Northern Virginia that Congress can address, so that's a good thing.
Absolutely. She has not been a stranger to Northern Virginia, and so certainly during her gubernatorial campaign, she was up here quite a bit, and I think she'll be great in Washington, and I hope she's victorious on Tuesday.
Yesterday, Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin unveiled his two-year state budget, which includes $1 billion in tax cuts. Some Northern Virginia lawmakers are concerned that would leave areas like education, including teacher pay, underfunded. Have you had a chance to review it yet? And if so, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I've done a cursory review. I haven't gotten through it in detail. I certainly like to see some of the education investments. Those are good. There's some public safety investments that are good. Mm-hmm. There's some mental health investments that are very good and very vital, may not be sufficient. I think the tax cuts, the General Assembly is going to need to have a conversation about that. And there are so many things that the state is not investing in that needs to. And so I'm certainly hesitant about that.
Worried that he's proposed? He did $4 billion in tax cuts last time around. Are you worried that he's paying attention to his national audience instead of his state audience?
My hope is that the governor will pay attention to what's going on here in Virginia. I know he was out on the campaign trail a lot last year. Hopefully this year he'll be a little bit more focused on what's going on in Richmond and across the Commonwealth. Some of the things that concern me about the budget proposal is, as I said, I'm hoping I'm concerned that it's not a sufficient amount of investment on the mental health side, given the challenge we're facing locally because of the state system and the challenges in the state system right now. Not having beds available is straining us. It's causing problems for both our public safety agencies and our local human services agencies. I've noticed the governor's attempting to legislate through the budget. He's put a 15-week abortion ban in the budget and trying to advance that. And I think we know where that goes. That's not supported by the majority of the Commonwealth. And we'll certainly oppose that up here.
Speaking of abortion, because you brought it up. Some people are concerned that the Virginia legislature might ban abortion or put some restrictions on it. There's already a bill that would completely ban it and says life begins at conception. Governor Glenn Youngkin has been on the record saying he would support a 15-week abortion ban. Are you expecting the legislature to change abortion laws this session?
And well, part of that is that there's a state Senate race down in the Hampton Roads area, which could... if a Republican wins there, that's another vote maybe against abortion.
Yeah, that state Senate race is absolutely critical. We have Aaron Rouse, who's a candidate down there to that's for Congresswoman-elect Kiggins' seat in the state Senate. So very, very important seat that I'm hopeful we will prevail in. And yeah, this is going to be a big issue in the session. Last session, the state Senate, the Democratic-controlled state Senate, did a great job of dispatching with those kinds of bills. And we're going to count on them to do the same this year. You know, I think those bills are out of the mainstream in Virginia, and voters have rejected that continuously, and I'm hopeful they'll do it again.
You wrote a letter to the governor saying that when he talked about housing, that you would worry. I thought that was a really great letter. I read the first two pages of it, and it sounded like you guys were fraternity brothers. Then I got to the end, and you said, well, we need more from you than what you've proposed. What is the key thing you need from the legislature and the governor in terms to do housing? Everyone knows in the metropolitan area, people are being priced out of housing. What do you want the governor to do that will help Alexandria's housing?
You know, I spent much of this conversation today talking about areas where we oppose the governor. This is an area where I think there's some commonality. You know, he's put out a housing plan. He's talked about the need to increase housing supply as a way to address affordability. That's something we've been talking about in Alexandria. And I know our friends in Arlington have been talking about aggressively as well. And so there is some commonality. We're not going to agree on anything. I think
but he kind of wants to throw open the doors to developers, right?
Yeah, I think some of what he's looking at is perhaps too aggressive and may not work ultimately. But I'll give you some examples of places where I think we agree. I think his ideas around making sure that housing is a component of economic development and economic attraction is absolutely key. We did that with Amazon under the previous governor, and it was very successful. His ideas around incentivizing local government with state housing money, local governments who adopt pro-growth land use policies, which is what we're trying to do in Alexandria, and I know our friends in Arlington are as well, we absolutely agree with that. We think the state should use its dollars to focus on those jurisdictions that are creating the kind of land use policies that promote private sector housing growth so that on the public sector side, you know, those are working in tandem. We think those are absolutely the right thing for the state to do. And so there's areas where I think we're gonna part ways. I think the governor's focus on punishing local governments who are not fast enough on making ministerial decisions. I think that's the wrong message.
It's a tonal issue with the governor that I find he doesn't just propose things. He wants to like jab people.
Well, you know, it's interesting because states all around the country are dealing with this. And it's funny because whether you have a conservative governor, you have a liberal governor, they're kind of reaching the same place on housing. They're just coming at it from different perspectives. And like you said, with different tone to how they're approaching it. And so I think there's some areas we can agree and try to get something done. And I think that's great.
Really quickly, we have about a minute left, but I want to bring up something else, which is the city health department. Alexandria wants an independent health department, something you would need, I believe, approved by the legislature. Can you tell us quickly how the local health department currently operates, why it's not independent, and then why you want to be independent from the Commonwealth?
In 30 seconds.
Yeah, so the Alexandria Health Department is a state agency. It's part of the Virginia Department of Health. The city of Alexandria provides over half of its budget. And so we are locally supplementing it because we have those extra services we want to provide. We're trying to get authority in order to consider this issue. This doesn't necessarily mean we're going to do it, but we want the authority to consider it. And so we're asking Richmond to give us that authority so that we can consider whether a local control for the health department is a better way to do it.
Well, we're almost out of time. I was going to ask you about your AAA bond rating again for Alexandria, but you don't have time to promote that.
Just affirmed. We're happy to have it reaffirmed.
That's all the
time. Saving the taxpayers millions.
That's all the time we have. Justin Wilson is the mayor of the city of Alexandria. Mayor Wilson, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Any big plans this weekend, Tom Sherwood?
I'll be wrapping up my Christmas shopping.
Wow.
You're not getting anything, I'll just tell you that
I'm not getting anything. I like to go the card route and not do too much money spending. Well, thank you all for listening and stay safe. I'm Sydney Grannon. Kojo Namdi will be back next week.
The Politics Hour was produced this week by Sydney Grannon, Ryan Bank, and Ruth Secular. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schrobstorff. Kellen Quigley is our engineer, and our broadcast engineer is Adrian Danhauser. Our phone screener is Bruce Romer. Tom Hudson oversees all the content that we make at WAMU. For past shows, visit thepoliticshour.org.